job, keeping the mercenaries' attention firmly fixed on them while Dominion's section moved around the flank. Across the canyon, Arcturus saw Horner, Yancey, and Mercurio rise from the rocks and aim their weapons at the enemy below. A few of the mercenaries looked up as Dominion's section appeared above them, and Arcturus relished their look of panic. "Fire!" shouted Arcturus. Withering sprays of impaler spikes ripped through the mercenaries, their lighter body armor no match for close-range gauze fire. Arcturus worked his rifle over the men below him, bloody eruptions fountaining where his spikes blew open skulls or tore limbs from bodies. Caught in the crossfire, the mercenaries had no chance. They danced in the vicious bursts of gunfire, trapped in the open and unable to fight back. The echoes of rifles were deafening as they filled the narrow defile in the canyon with screaming hot spikes. A few of the mercenaries managed to bring their weapons to bear, but it was too little, too late, and they were cut down without mercy. Realizing that to fight on was hopeless, one man threw down his rifle and held up his hands in surrender. Arcturus cut him in two with a sustained burst of fire. It was over in a few seconds, and the canyon was suddenly quiet as the Marines of Dominion section ceased firing. Acrid smoke drifted from the heated barrels of their guns as they looked at each other in disbelief, shocked at the carnage they'd caused, but elated to have survived and won their first firefight. "Good job, everyone," said Arcturus, his heart rate only now beginning to return to normal after the thrill of killing these men. The canyon floor resembled an abattoir, shredded flesh and blood mingling in thick, viscous puddles that were already congealing into sticky pools in the heat. "Man, we killed those SOBs good!" shouted Yancey, his rifle held triumphantly above his head. Chuck Horner sketched Arcturus a salute, and even Toby Mercurio looked pleased for once. Beside him, Dia DeSanto and Chun Liang butted helmets, and he felt them slap the shoulder guards of his armor in triumph. "You did it, LT," cried DeSanto. "We killed a whole damn lot of them." "That we did," agreed Arcturus, only now beginning to appreciate the slaughter he had orchestrated. He knew that some men experienced a great and terrible guilt over killing other human beings. But as he looked at the ripped-open sacks of meat and bone that had, only minutes before, been living, breathing human beings, he felt nothing for them. Nothing at all. Arcturus looked up at the miners' encampment through the optical viewfinders, seeking any sign of weapons technology, like the missile turret that had downed their dropship. Sure enough, another pair of turrets with sweeping dishes not dissimilar to those they'd left behind at Camp Juno were placed at the forefront of the encampment. The mining complex was a well-organized collection of modular constructions built on an artificially created plateau at the mouth of a great scar in the mountainside that resembled the lair of some prehistoric monster. The edge of the plateau had been built up into a defended ridge with sandbagged foxholes and concrete bunkers. A pair of Goliath combat walkers plodded back and forth behind the barricades on their reverse-jointed legs, the rotary cannons on their weapon arms spooling up and the missile systems above the pilot's canopy trained on the sky. Arcturus wasn't too concerned with the Goliaths. They were primarily used to engage airborne targets, though the power of their guns wasn't to be sniffed at if you were a grunt on the ground. In any case, he had just the thing to fight Goliaths. He smiled as he saw the panicked miners and their mercenaries running back and forth, terrified at the sight that had just come into view on the rutted road that led to the main gate of the mine complex. The siege tank had finally rumbled into the bloody canyon 30 minutes after the conclusion of the fighting. Since the battle's end, Dominion Section had been securing the weapons and ammo of the fallen Marines and gathering up the dead. Of the Marines who had charged in the wake of the firebats, only 5 were left alive. The rest arranged in neat rows alongside the 8 wounded and those who had perished in the crash. The bodies of the mercenaries were dragged to the side of the canyon and their weapons taken, but were otherwise ignored. An evac bird was called in to take Captain Emelian and the wounded back to Camp Juno. Once Arcturus received confirmation that it had been dispatched, he and Dominion Section, together with the 5 resocked Marines, rode the tank farther up the valley. After all, they had a job to finish.
"Oh, yeah!"
shouted Yancey Gray, standing on the tank's frontal glacis and balancing himself by holding on to its enormous cannon.
"Not so cocky now, are you? Not so tough when you see we got ourselves a tank! Yeah!"
The siege tank had the range to engage the miners' camp from where they sat now, its main gun more than capable of pounding the camp to smoldering ruin without fear of reprisal. But Arcturus didn't want to destroy the mining facility if he could avoid it. Not if there was a chance it could be taken and put to use.
"Shut up, Yancey," said Arcturus, handing the optical viewers to Toby Mercurio and removing his helmet.
He deposited the helmet on the tank's track guard and dropped down to the ground.
"Chuck, Dia, you're with me. Shoulder those weapons and make sure they're safed."
Horner and DeSanto dropped to the hard-packed ground as Arcturus marched uphill along the road toward the mining complex, his rifle hanging by its sling from his shoulder. After the frenetic carnage of the battle, this was almost peaceful. The road to the mine was relatively shielded from the fierce winds that swept the lowest reaches of the mountains. Arcturus watched as a group of 5 men emerged from the complex above. 3 were armed, more mercenaries, presumably, while the 2 others had the weathered, permanently dirty texture of dyed-in-the-wool prospectors.
"LT, what you got in mind?" asked Chuck Horner.
"Yeah, I was kind of wondering that too," said DeSanto.
"We're going to talk to them," said Arcturus, "and ask them to surrender."
"Surrender?" said Horner. "I gotta say, LT, they don't look like the surrendering kind."
"You leave that to me, Charles."
The 2 groups met at a bend in the road, some 200 meters from the camp's gate, and Arcturus felt the hostility of the miners like a blow. One man was short and thick-set, his flesh leathery and pitted from a life in hostile environments. The other was similarly squat, but his eyes had a wary quality to them that told Arcturus he wasn't going to be the one doing the talking. The mercenaries kept back, though they made a point of showing that they were more than ready to use their weapons. Before Arcturus could even open his mouth, the first man thrust out a sheaf of grubby, oil-stained papers and said,
"This ain't your property, confed. We own this claim fair and square. Go tell your bosses that we got the paperwork and everything. You understand me?"
Arcturus nodded politely and said,
"My name is Lieutenant Arcturus Mangsk of the Confederate Marine Corps. Am I speaking with the head of this facility?"
The man with the papers looked at him suspiciously and said,
"Yeah, I guess you are."
"And you are?"
"Lemuel Baden. Not that it makes a damn bit of difference. We ain't got nothing to say to each other."
"I beg to differ," said Arcturus. "That's not entirely correct. I have a siege tank that says we have one very important matter to discuss."
"Yeah? What's that, then?"
"Your immediate surrender and relocation to another planet."
Baden snorted with what Arcturus assumed was laughter.
Surrender? Hell, you got some nerve, boy! What are you, anyway? 20? 21?
19, actually. This time, both prospectors laughed.
Go home, boy, snapped Baden. I ain't gonna surrender, leastways not to a kid that don't even need to shave.
Oh, I think you'll surrender, said Arcturus. In fact, I'm sure of it.
And why's that?
Because I have a siege tank, and if you don't surrender, I'll blow this place to hell.
Don't make me laugh, sneered Baden. You wouldn't dare.
Try me, said Arcturus, meeting Baden's hostile stare with one of his own.
Arcturus saw beads of sweat gathering at the miner's temples. He could see courage in Baden's eyes, but also the wariness of not being able to read the young soldier standing before him.
Right now, you're trying to work out if I'm bluffing, said Arcturus. I can assure you that I am not.
I never bluff. If I walk away from this parley without your surrender, you and everyone within your compound will be dead inside of 10 minutes. I guarantee it.
Then maybe we ought to just kill you now, snapped Baden.
You could, but then my men would kill you and everyone would die regardless, replied Arcturus. So you see, you really only have one option.
Baden's eyes flicked to his companion, who said,
You goddamn confeds can't keep doing this to us! This here mine's ours, and we ain't gonna let you take it from us!
Arcturus ignored the man's outburst, knowing that Baden was the only man worth talking to in this exchange.
Easy, Pill, leave this to me, said Baden.
The miner looked back to Arcturus.
Give me 20 minutes to talk to my people.
Of course, said Arcturus. But if I do not have your surrender after that, you're going to see exactly how powerful that tank is. And trust me, you don't want that.
Baden nodded, then stomped back to the mine complex with his companions without another word. Arcturus watched them go and turned on his heel, marching back down the road to where his marines and the siege tank awaited. Arcturus banged on the tank's side when he finally reached it. Stand down the gun.
You were bluffing? Asked Dia DeSanto.
No, said Arcturus. As I told Baden, I never bluff. I already know he's going to surrender.
You sure? Asked Chuck Horner. He looked like a stubborn mule, that one.
Arcturus nodded. Indeed. But he isn't stupid.
Sir?
Said DeSanto. He knows I'll destroy the mine and kill everyone there if he doesn't surrender, explained Arcturus.
Chuck Horner looked askance at Arcturus.
You ain't kidding, are you?
No, said Arcturus. I'm not. And Lemuel Baden knows that.
The infirmary building of Camp Juno was a sterile, antiseptic place in every sense of the word. Its prefabricated walls were gleaming white and faced with ceramic tiles that reflected the unflattering lights strung from the green-painted girders that formed the roof vault. Its structure resembled a fat tube split down its length and dropped onto the ground. Pods of beds were spread throughout the open space, with ceiling-mounted extractors trying and failing to circulate the stagnant air and diminish the tang of disinfectant. Medics made their rounds of the injured, checking machine readings and administering pain meds, while Marines stripped out of their armor and wearing fatigues visited those comrades who weren't too sedated. Arcturus had expected the infirmary to be noisy, but it was instead subdued, filled with the quiet noise of professionals working hard and a background machine hum. The atmosphere was calm by virtue of the fact that the majority of the wounded Marines here were kept heavily sedated, since many of them were resocked. Numerous studies had shown that extreme trauma could have a negative impact on the strength of the neural reprogramming implanted over a subject's original memories, and no one was taking any chances that these Marines might relapse to their previous murderous personalities. Having heard the lurid details of some of the more outrageous crimes committed by these Marines prior to having acceptable behavioral patterns stamped on their brains, Arcturus was pleased to see such precautions in place. He spotted Captain Emelian lying in a bed pod she shared with three other wounded soldiers, two men and another woman, and made his way over to her. Emelian smiled as she saw Arcturus approaching, then grimaced as she tried to sit up, the framework of silver steel encasing her pelvis and legs, making even that simple act awkwardly painful. The swelling around her eyes and jaw had begun to come down, and her bruises had turned an attractive shade of puce. Opposite the scar Emelian had received on Chao Sara was another angry red line of sutures. Each of the patients in the pod was hooked up to drips and monitored by complicated banks of boxy machinery, and Arcturus carefully negotiated his way through a tangle of wires to get to Emelian's bed. "Good morning, Captain," said Arcturus.
"Morning, Lieutenant,"
replied Emelian as Arcturus took a seat next to her bed, placing a portable console at her feet.
"You're looking well." "Sure," said Emelian. "I look like crap. Nobody will give me a mirror. What does that tell you?"
"That even when you are nearly killed, you're still incredibly vain."
"Watch it, Buster," said Emelian. "I may be off my feet, but I'm still your superior officer."
Arcturus raised his hands in mock surrender.
"Point taken," he said.
"I hear the rest of the op went well."
"Yes," agreed Arcturus. "We got to the Taronga facility and took it without a shot being fired. Apart from the ones in the canyon after we were blown out of the sky."
Emelian's face darkened at the mention of the crash.
"I don't remember anything of that," she said. "They tell me I smashed my head on a stanchion and broke my helmet open. Damn near crushed my skull."
"You were lucky," said Arcturus.
"Yeah, so everyone keeps telling me."
"At least now you have a matching scar,"
pointed out Arcturus.
"Gee, that's a comfort."
"Sorry."
"So tell me about the rest of the mission," said Emelian. "I got the gist of it from one of the few of my Marines you deigned to bring back alive, but they aren't great with the storytelling, you know. To be honest, there isn't much else to tell."
"When someone says to be honest, that usually means they're lying."
"I'll keep that in mind," said Arcturus. "But you probably already know the rest. Lemuel Baden came out after his 20 minutes were up and said his people would be leaving. They deactivated their reactor and powered down the turrets, and I arranged for a pair of dropships to escort them back here for a debriefing before they're shipped off-world. We secured the complex, and there's a Cucinus mining team swarming over it already, which I'd like permission to supervise, Captain."
"Still dreaming of being a prospector, eh?"
"Absolutely," said Arcturus.
"So, how'd you convince Baden to bring his people out?"
"Simple. I told him I'd level the place with the siege tank."
"That's it?"
"Yes," said Arcturus. "That was very convincing."
"Would you have opened fire if they hadn't come out?"
"Of course," said Arcturus without hesitation. "What's the point of making a threat if you're not willing to back it up?"
"That would have been a very expensive decision, Lieutenant," said Emelian. "A lot of people with higher pay grades than us were very clear that they wanted that place intact."
"And they have it. Baden knew I was serious, and he didn't want to die. It's that simple."
Emelian shook her head.
No, Minsk, it's not that simple.
It's not?
No. Remember, I've read your file and I know all about you, said Emelian. I know that you mean what you say, but you don't always say what you think. You keep almost everything of what goes on inside you close to your chest, and you don't let anyone see what you're thinking unless you want them to. And right then, you wanted Baden to know what you were thinking.
I suppose so, agreed Arcturus. It worked, didn't it?
That it did, said Emelian. And just for that I might forgive you for getting most of my soldiers killed or maimed in that canyon.
It was a textbook maneuver, said Arcturus. One element kept the enemy's attention fixed while others flanked them.
Almost textbook, because the guys providing the distraction for the flankers aren't supposed to get killed. Suppression fire? You ever hear of it?
I have, but there wasn't any other way to be sure the mercenaries' attention would be firmly fixed to their front.
Well, you sure as hell managed that,
said Emelian, flicking her hair back from her face and reaching for a cup of water beside her bed. She grunted painfully, and Arcturus swiftly moved to lift the cup into her hand.
Thanks, said Emelian. Now, tell me why you're really here.
Excuse me?
Come on, you didn't come here just to inspect my latest scar, did you?
Arcturus shrugged, then realized there was no point in beating around the bush. Emelian had read the truth off him, either in his body language or simply via the instincts of a senior officer.
There was one thing I wanted to discuss with you, yes, began Arcturus.
Come on, spit it out, said Emelian. You think I've got nothing better to do than sit here listening to you? There's hot Confederate doctors working these wards, and a girl's got to think of when she musters out.
Arcturus smiled.
And now you're using humor to try and put me at my ease.
Jeez, way to overanalyze, muttered Emelian. Pain meds must be kicking in. I'm normally more subtle than that. Okay. So, what is it?
Arcturus lifted the portable console from the foot of her bed and activated it with a touch. A green glow spread over the screen, followed by the insignia of the Marine Corps.
I observed Lemuel Baden's debriefing, said Arcturus.
Who was doing the debrief?
Captain Graves flew in from Camp Lawson to conduct it.
He's a good man, said Emelian. Gets a job done quickly and he gets results.
Well, Baden's debrief was certainly over very quickly. However, whether it could be said that the job was done satisfactorily is another matter.
What do you mean?
Lemuel said the mine legally belonged to him and the other miners, and their claim predated any Confederate interest on Sonyan. He had papers, but it seems they've been confiscated, and, wouldn't you know it, no one can find them now.
Emelian shrugged.
Marine Corps admin snafu happens all the time.
I'm sure, said Arcturus dryly,
turning the console around for Emelian to see.
The point is, I checked with the Kalmorian registration database, and I found claim dockets for Taronga Canyon registered to one Lemuel Baden of Tarsonas from 6 years ago.
What's your point?
The first Confederacy ship to make planetfall on Sonyan was the Jonestown in 77.
Emelian crossed her arms.
I see. And you think it matters that they were here first?
Doesn't it? If his claim to the mine is legal, then
haven't we just stolen it from him? You secure that crap, soldier?
Snapped Emelian.
And don't let me hear you repeat it. Lemuel Baden is part of the Kalmorian Combine, a bunch of good-for-nothing crooks and pirates. Hell, most of their prospectors are wanted criminals anyway.
That's a bit of a generalization, surely.
Is it? Listen, Mengsk. The core worlds depend on the minerals and fuels extracted from mines like this. So do you really want us to be beholden to Kalmorian criminals? Sarnian is part of the Confederacy now, and anything on it belongs to the Confederacy. And the Marine Corps will fight to protect our way of life. You got that?
Yes, but how?
But nothing, Lieutenant,
said Emelian, leaning forward and keeping her voice level.
If you want to survive in the military, you're going to have to stop acting like some damn Boy Scout. In the Marines, you follow the orders you're given, and that's it, period. You go sticking your nose in places it don't belong, and you're liable to get it bitten off. That's what being in the Marines is all about, Nansk. Orders. We start deciding the orders we want to obey and the ones we don't, and you know what you get? Anarchy. And I'm not going to allow that in the 33rd.
Anger touched Arcturus, and he said, Sounds like you want everyone to be like one of your re-sock Marines. Wasn't that exactly why you brought Dominion Section in? Because we weren't mindless automatons? Because we could think for ourselves?
I brought you in because I need good officers I can trust to follow orders, said Emelian.
I thought you would understand that, Minsk, but maybe I was wrong. So you think you're some kind of rebel like your father, is that it?
What does my father have to do with anything?
I've watched the UNN, said Emelian. I've seen your father speaking out against the Confederacy and stirring up trouble on Core Hall. Are you like him, looking for trouble when there's no need to?
I'm nothing like my father, said Arcturus.
Yeah? Sure could have fooled me, said Emelian, pointing toward Arcturus's console.
I'm nothing like my father,
repeated Arcturus more forcefully this time.
He's an embarrassment, stirring up trouble when there's no need for it.
Just like you're doing here, said Emelian.
Her tone softened, and she sat back.
Look, I'm not trying to rain on your parade, Mansk, but trust me. This isn't an avenue you want to go down. The Marine Corps is a machine, and we're all just cogs in that machine. You start messing with that, and either the machine chews you up and spits you out, or it breaks down. You can get yourself spat out if you want, but I'm not going to allow our part of the machine to break down. It'll be my ass in a sling with Commander Foley if you start pissing off the brass with damn fool questions. You get me?
I get you, said Arcturus. And you're right. I'll stop asking questions.
Good,
said Emelian, searching his face for any sign he was soft-soaping her. Arcturus knew his captain was good at reading people, but she was dead right when she said that he didn't let anyone see what was going on below the surface. He kept his face utterly blank now, and she relaxed. Satisfied, she'd quashed his nascent doubts.
Okay, she said. Now go enjoy your leave, Minsk. Go home, relax with the family, eat good food, get drunk or get laid, I don't care. Just come back with your head in the game. Are we clear?
Yes, Arcturus nodded. We're clear.
Good. Now get out of here, soldier. I need to get some sleep.
Arcturus nodded and pushed back the chair as he stood. He saluted Emelian and picked his way through the tangle of cables and wires from the bedside monitors. As he turned away from Emelian, she asked,
You got any kids, Minx?
Arcturus shook his head.
You know I don't. Just as well, eh? What's that supposed to mean? With your family, just imagine what they'd turn out like.
Chapter 9. Arcturus stepped from the ground car, a gleaming 79 cobalt blue Terra Zephyr, adjusting the collar of his dress uniform as he did so. He wasn't particularly interested in motor vehicles beyond their ability to get him from point A to point B, but even he had to admit that the Zephyr was a fine piece of machinery, with smooth, graceful lines, a plush leather interior, and an engine that purred like a contented feline. He turned and offered his hand to Juliana Pasteur, who accepted his gracious gesture and emerged from the ground car with effortless elegance. The 2 years since Arcturus had seen Juliana had been good to her, and she had blossomed from a pretty young girl into a beautiful woman. Now 18, she had filled out in all the right places, and carried herself with a confidence and poise that most other women could only dream of. Dressed in a simple, backless black dress and tasteful jewelry that matched her eyes, Juliana turned heads as she took Arcturus's arm. The night was balmy and warm, with a salt-tinged breeze blowing in off the ocean, and Juliana wrapped a sheer pashmina around her shoulders as they set off along the tree-lined Cefad Boulevard toward the restaurant. Behind them, following at a discreet distance, were two slab-shouldered men in gray suits, Umojin security personnel who accompanied Juliana whenever she traveled off-world. Arcturus could sense their dislike of him, or at least what his uniform represented, but wasn't surprised by it. The Confederacy had forever been trying to coerce Umoja into its embrace, but the Umojins were a fiercely independent people and had steadfastly refused to join with the government of Tarsonis. Cefad Boulevard was a pedestrianized walkway in the heart of the recreational district of El Sicaro, one of Tirador IX's most exclusive resort cities, and thus they had to make the rest of the journey on foot. Arcturus didn't mind, for it gave him a chance to bask in the cinnamon-scented air and enjoy the fact that he wasn't being shot at. Tirador IX was one of the later colony worlds, a planet that co-orbited its sister world of Tirador VIII. Ever since its colonization, it had been a popular tourist destination, thanks to its distance from the bustle of Tarsonis and its unique ecology. The orbital dance performed by the two outermost planets in the Tirador system had blessed Tirador IX with an incredible variety of ecosystems and climates. A journey of only a few kilometers could result in a huge change in temperature, humidity, or terrain, which allowed the enterprising colonists to create a wonderland where almost any form of paradise could be replicated. Ski resorts sat cheek by jowl with jungles and rugged coastal towns where intrepid holidaymakers could dive in the emerald waters to see the playful Tiradorian narwhal. Achingly beautiful deserts sprawled in the lee of soaring, snow-capped peaks where the rich and famous lived in mountaintop villas accessible only by orbital flyers. Many of the old families kept private enclaves on Tirador IX, estates where they could enjoy whatever holiday they desired. Rumor had it that it was often a hideaway for family shames, and salacious gossip had many an errant scion sent here, far from Tarsonis and investigative reporters. Arcturus cared nothing for such things, content just to relax and enjoy his leave far from thoughts of killing. He'd arrived on Tirador IX that morning and would be heading onward to Korhal in the next day or so. A week later, and he'd have to return to his unit. So he wasn't going to waste time thinking about combat suits, C-14 gauze rifles, or blood and death until he had to.
"It's beautiful, isn't it?"
said Juliana, threading her arm through his and looking up at the fabulous buildings on either side of them. Arcturus smiled.
"Yes, certainly an improvement on what I'm used to. SCVs might be an efficient way to build things, but they do tend toward a uniformity of architecture."
"I love it," said Juliana. "There's no two alike."
That was certainly true, The boulevard was paved with irregularly patterned bricks, and the structures around them had a rustic charm and individuality that was sadly lacking on the core worlds. They passed wooden-fronted shops selling tourist junk alongside ad hoc art galleries of local painters and delicatessens serving food from all across the sector. Eateries and bars of all descriptions vied for their attention, and the wafting aroma of a dozen different cuisines blended together in a mouth-watering smorgasbord of sensation. Having lived on mess hall slop for so long, Arcturus suddenly realized how much he missed proper food. Silken lamps hung from ironwork posts, and fiber-optic lines of multicolored lights were looped through the branches of trees, giving the boulevard a pleasingly festive air. People thronged the streets, men and women of obvious breeding and wealth. Arcturus saw that many of these faces had a strange and slightly unsettling uniformity to them, and guessed that most had been sculpted with augmetic surgery or gene therapy. Street entertainers amused passers-by with music, puppet shows, and conjuring tricks, and the sound of laughter drifted on the breeze. Farther along the street, Arcturus saw a group of soldiers drinking outside a rough-and-ready bar, their cries for drinks and wolf whistles at passing women out of character with the rest of the boulevard. They spotted Arcturus, and almost immediately the volume of their shouts diminished. Arcturus nodded respectfully to the soldiers, their uniform insignias marking them as privates and low-ranked NCOs. One of the soldiers, a young boy who looked barely old enough to be in uniform, stood and saluted Arcturus as he passed.
"Evening, Lieutenant! Evening, miss!"
said the boy, and Arcturus could smell the alcohol on his breath from several feet away.
"Evening, soldier," replied Arcturus, returning the salute and stopping beside the bar. None of these men would be resocked, and thus it would be bad form not to pass a few words with them, though it wouldn't do to be overly familiar with them.
"What's your name, son?" he asked.
"Private Shaw, sir. 57th Marine Combat Engineers, sir."
"Are you men behaving yourselves?" asked Arcturus with a broad smile. "Upholding the fine tradition of the Corps?"
"Sir, yes, sir!"
cried the soldiers, raising their drinks.
"Good work, man," said Arcturus. "Carry on and behave yourselves."
"Absolutely, sir," said Private Shaw. "Don't you worry about us, sir."
"It isn't you I'm worried about," said Arcturus. "It's the local women I'm thinking of."
The soldiers laughed, and Arcturus saluted once more, before turning away and continuing onward with Juliana. The noise of the soldiers swelled as Juliana squeezed his arm.
"You look very smart in your uniform," said Juliana. "It suits you."
Arcturus smiled. He did look good in uniform. 2 years of military service had put meat on his bones and muscle on his limbs. His features had hardened, and he carried himself with a confidence he'd certainly possessed as a young man, but which he now wore like a second skin.
"Thank you, Juliana. I've already told you that you look beautiful tonight, but you can never compliment a lady too much, can you?"
"Certainly not," agreed Juliana. "It's been 2 years since I've seen you, Arcturus, and I wanted to make an impression."
"You certainly succeeded," said Arcturus, looking around him. "Certainly, every man with a pulse seems to think so."
She smiled and said,
"Well, if I'm turning heads, I'm not the only one. You're getting your fair share of attention, too, you know."
Arcturus had noticed that he was attracting smiles from some of the women, and even a few men, promenading the boulevard, but had modestly chosen not to mention it. Some were plainly lustful, but most were simply nods of respect for his service in the military.
Well, they do say that women love a man in uniform.
It's true, said Juliana in a playfully meek-sounding voice. We are a weak species, and are easily undone by the subtle wiles of man.
If only you knew, thought Arcturus. The restaurant itself was a curious mix of fringe world kitsch and core world chic, and Arcturus couldn't make up his mind whether he loathed it or thought it charming. Juliana made the decision for him when she laughed at the sight of it and clapped her hands, declaring it wonderfully authentic. The floor was wooden, scuffed and discolored from the tread of thousands of diners, and the air was smoky with rich, homely smells. Perhaps 100 people filled the restaurant, and the animated buzz of conversation provided a pleasing backdrop. They were seated without fuss in a cozy booth screened from the tables on either side by wooden dividers pierced by stained glass panels. The seats were comfortable, and they ordered their food from a pretty waitress who seemed genuinely pleased to serve them. They made small talk for a while, Juliana regaling him with tales of her final year at the Umoja Institute and her new life as a budding lawyer. She had begun working as a paralegal with a firm that specialized in stellar shipping laws, and she hoped to gain her full qualifications within a couple of years at most. Both Juliana and her father were still making regular trips to Korhal to see Arcturus's father, but sensing that such a topic would not be conducive to an enjoyable evening, she wisely kept her talk of Korhal light. In turn, Arcturus spoke to her of his life in the Marines, telling her of his tour on Pridewater and the Battle of Taronga Canyon, though he spared her the goriest details and omitted his lack of empathy at the deaths he'd caused. Some things weren't meant for the dinner table. The food arrived promptly, and Arcturus was mildly surprised to find that it was excellent. He had ordered a dish of andouille sausage and shrimp with spicy mustard sauce, while Juliana had decided upon a creamy polenta with a mushroom and sausage ragout. They shared mouthfuls of each other's dinner and drank wine poured from a carafe of translucent blue glass. As they ate, they flirted outrageously, Arcturus blending just the right amount of compliments and self-deprecating humor to keep Juliana smiling, and she frequently reaching over the table to take his hand or brush his arm. The conversation flowed naturally and effortlessly, and without even realizing it, Arcturus found that he was genuinely enjoying himself. Juliana took a drink of wine and said, "So, do you like being a soldier?" The question surprised Arcturus, for it was apropos of nothing, and he had been careful to keep his depiction of day-to-day life in the military as neutral as possible. "I suppose so," he said. "I think I enjoy more aspects of it than I don't. As long as you do what you're told, it's not so bad."
"I can't picture you liking that," remarked Juliana.
"I don't have a problem with authority, per se," explained Arcturus. "I have a problem when I think the person giving me an order is an idiot. I suppose the Marine Corps is like any other organization, with good people and bad people in its hierarchy. The trouble is that in the Marine Corps, the bad ones might get me killed."
"Don't say that," warned Juliana. "It's not good to tempt fate."
Arcturus chuckled dismissively. "Fate? I don't believe in fate. A person makes his own decisions and has to live with the consequences. Logic and order are what determine the shape of our lives, not fate. Anyway, now that I've seen some real combat, it won't be long before I get a promotion and move farther away from the front line."
"I told you so, didn't I?" Juliana said, laughing. I told you that you'd be a general soon.
Well, you said 6 months,
but I think it might take a little longer than that. Pedant,
pouted Juliana. Sorry.
And are you learning about mine workings, prospecting and stuff like that?
Arcturus shrugged. So far, only by taking them by force from other mining outfits, which seems to be the way of things on the Rim Territories. The Intelligence Division, an oxymoron if ever there was one, sends in a scout recon force on a given planet to find out what's being mined, who's mining it, and who they're affiliated with. Then the data hounds scour the networks to try and find a legal loophole or a criminal record that they can use to justify sending in a force of gun-toting marines to bully the miners away.
That's terrible, said Juliana, shaking her head. And the Tarsonis Council wonders why Umoja won't make an alliance with them?
It's not so bad, though. I've supervised a number of Confederate-affiliated mining outfits when they go in to take over, and I've learned a lot from that. Or at least, I've learned a lot of how not to run a working mine.
But the Confederacy is stealing those claims, pointed out Juliana. My father says that the Council is getting greedier every year, that pretty soon they won't even bother coming up with spurious justifications for their thefts. He says eventually they'll just take what they want by force, and soon there won't be anyone to stop them.
That sounds like my father talking.
Yes, well, he might be right, you know, said Juliana, hesitantly, knowing that she was risking an angry exchange by bringing up Angus Mengsk.
But thoughts of Angus didn't anger Arcturus so much now. Irritatingly, the more years that passed, the more he found himself thinking back to his father with the uncomfortable realization that a great deal of what he'd said now made sense. Growing up, Arcturus had always thought of his father as the stern, authoritarian patriarch of the Mengsk family, a man utterly unsympathetic to the concerns and ambitions of his young son. In Arcturus's adolescent world, Angus Mengsk had never been young, never run wild, or known what it was like to be a teenager, a creature possessed of a deluded belief in its own infinite wisdom and a conceited sense of entitlement and immortality.
Maybe, conceded Arcturus, and he smiled at the look of astonishment on Juliana's face.
I'm not saying he was right about everything, but the more I see, the more I think that perhaps he knew what he was talking about after all.
So, what does that mean for you now?
I don't know, said Arcturus, and that admission was more painful than he had imagined it would be. His self-belief had seen him through his tempestuous relationship with his father, but to know that he hadn't steered his destiny as cleverly as he thought was a galling realization. I have to finish out my term in the Marines, said Arcturus. But once that's done, I'm heading out into space and away from all this. Somewhere the Confederacy doesn't care about, and where I can live my life away from politicking and corruption.
That might be a hard place to find.
It might be, admitted Arcturus. But when I get back to Core Hall, I'm going to think long and hard as to where it might be.
Are you going to see your father when you go back home?
Yes, said Arcturus. It's the first time I've gone back to Core Hall on leave, so Mother has arranged a grand family dinner. My attendance is apparently mandatory. I'm dreading it.
Nonsense, said Juliana, reaching over the table to take his hands. It will be wonderful.
I hope so, Arcturus said with a smile, the idea of rapprochement between himself and his family giving him an alien but not unwelcome sensation in the pit of his stomach. Though, to tell you the truth, he said, I'm more worried about seeing Dorothy. I think she's still mad at me for leaving, and that little girl can't hold a mean grudge.
She's not so little anymore, said Juliana. She's a precocious 6-year-old now, the grand matriarch of her junior school.
Arcturus smiled with real pleasure at the thought of Dorothy ruling the roost at school.
She's a Minsk, he said. It's what we do.
With the meal finished, Arcturus paid the bill, and they left the restaurant and emerged into the fragrant, ocean-scented evening of Tirador 9. The lights garlanding the trees shone like miniature stars, their brightness waxing and waning, and the silk lanterns bobbed in the freshening wind from the coast. The air had cooled, and Juliana pulled her pashmina tightly around her shoulders. Safed Boulevard was busier than it had been earlier, the crowds drawn by the glittering lights, festive feel, and many attractions designed to part them from their cash. Arcturus watched the smiling faces walking past him, attractive men and women, and felt a wave of annoyance that he would have to leave so soon. Tirador 9 was a place of comfort and respite, and it would be nice to return here sometime soon. Juliana slipped her hand into his, and they walked, hand in hand, back along the street, with the two Umojan security personnel following at a discreet distance.
Thank you, said Juliana.
For what?
For tonight. I had a wonderful time, Arcturus. I like being around you.
Arcturus smiled, pleased at the compliment, and said,
Yes, I enjoyed myself as well.
You sound surprised, said Juliana.
I don't mean to, said Arcturus, suddenly finding that he was genuinely sad to be leaving her tomorrow. It's just that it's been a while since I've been in genteel company.
You spend enough time with soldiers, it's easy to forget the simple pleasure of spending an evening with a beautiful woman.
Well, as long as you think I'm beautiful, that's all that matters.
You are beautiful, said Arcturus. I don't think you know it, and that's what makes it so incredible.
Juliana squeezed his hand tightly and stopped, leaning up to kiss him.
You realize, she said, that flattery will get you everywhere.
Then you'd better get used to it, he said, kissing her back.
A raucous cheer sounded from nearby, and Arcturus looked up to see the soldiers they had passed earlier, waving at them from the bar, their glasses raised in salute.
Just like graduation, said Juliana with a smile.
Arcturus smiled and sketched a roguish salute to his fellow Marines.
Almost, he said. I think these men are a little tougher than the students of Sterling.
Even as Arcturus formed the thought, the hairs on the back of his neck bristled, and he turned to see a group of 5 men lounging by one of the handcrafted iron benches at the side of the boulevard. They looked out of place, their features rugged and pinched, the faces of men who had grown to adulthood without a proper, balanced, nutritious diet. It was a peculiar facet of human development Arcturus had noticed, that you could tell the quality of a person's upbringing from the briefest glance at their facial bone structure. Even down to their skin, there was a definite difference in the development of the face that distinguished rich from poor. These men fell into the latter category, without a doubt, and he wondered why they had not moved on. Perhaps they were indentured workers on a break, remembering how Diamond DeSanto's family had labored behind the scenes to make the resorts of Tirador 9 such paradises. Then why were they here, mingling with resort guests and their betters? One of the men looked straight at him, a man with a bulky trench coat that reached to his shins and whose head was shaven clean, with a tattoo of a snake coiled around his ear.
"Is something wrong?"
asked Juliana, sensing the sudden tension in his posture.
No, it's nothing," he said, not wishing to alarm her.
As she followed his gaze, Arcturus looked behind Juliana to where her security loitered, both men watching a pair of silver-skinned flyers pass overhead. He looked at the shaven-headed man with the snake tattoo, and their eyes met through the laughing crowds.
"Juliana, get inside,"
he said, recognizing the hard stare of a professional killer.
"What?"
she said, but Arcturus was already moving, dragging her back toward her guards while keeping his eyes fixed on the occupants of the bench. The man with the tattoo saw Arcturus move and knew that his cover was blown. He said something to the man next to him and reached inside his long trench coat. Arcturus instinctively reached for his slug thrower, but his hand grasped empty air. The pistol resting in its locked, foam-lined case in his hotel room's safe. Snake Tattoo raised a long-barreled weapon, an old model AGR-14 assault rifle, and Arcturus' heart hammered against his ribs as he saw it. He had gone through boot camp with such a rifle, a no-nonsense gun capable of firing supersonic, jacketless slugs that could tear through a human body and leave nothing behind but shredded meat and bone. The four men with the tattooed assassin unveiled a varied mix of pistols and rifles.
"Gun!"
shouted Arcturus. Heads turned, too slowly, and Arcturus bore Juliana down with him as he heard the screams of the crowd upon their seeing the guns. Juliana cried out as she hit the ground, but the deafening roar of gunfire swallowed the sound. The AGR-14 was a powerful weapon, one designed as much to intimidate as to wound, and Arcturus scrambled on all fours, Juliana beside him. He looked over at the gunmen, watching as they played their fire over the front of the bar beside them. The wooden frontage of the bar exploded into splinters, the glass shattering like a million diamonds. Marines danced in the gunfire, blood sprayed, and the sound of bullets striking flesh was like a hammer repeatedly smacking raw steak. Arcturus saw Private Shaw hurled backward by the terrible impacts, his chest blown out by a sawing blast of rounds. Other men were hit as well, and Arcturus saw a soldier torn almost in two by a torrent of fire. Shots sounded from behind Arcturus, and he saw one of Juliana's security guards crouched on his knee, his pistol held out in front of him in two hands. One of the gunmen dropped, the back of his head missing, and the guard calmly drew a bead on another. Before he could shoot again, a burst of rifle fire took him in the chest, and he lurched backward, a bloody line of bullet holes tearing him up as though a grenade had gone off inside his ribcage. Juliana's other guard scooted over to them.
"Give me her!"
he shouted. Arcturus nodded and hauled Juliana over to the man.
"Arcturus!"
she cried, but he forced himself to ignore her plea, as he spotted the fallen guard's pistol on the ground. He scrambled over to the gun and swept it up, twisting onto his back and aiming it toward the bench. Hordes of people ran in panicked confusion along the boulevard, screaming over the terror that had landed in their midst. The bar was a ruin of shattered timber and glass. Tables had been overturned, chairs scattered, and bloody bodies littered the area in front, like multiple victims of a firing squad. Snake Tattoo and his three comrades continued to rake bullets over the bar's frontage, making the corpses jerk with the impacts. Fury touched Arcturus at the slaughter of his fellow Marines. The pistol bucked in his hand, and another of the gunmen dropped. Arcturus rolled to his knees and shifted his aim, putting another enemy on his back, a bloody hole blasted in his chest. His accomplices turned toward the source of this new threat. Another pistol shot boomed, and Arcturus knew that Juliana's other guard was returning fire. The man's bullet missed, and Snake Tattoo's companion swung his rifle to bear, a look of hatred in his eyes. Arcturus fired first, but his shot went wide. A bar light that had miraculously survived the initial hail of bullets blew out in a rain of glass. Supersonic slugs ripped toward Juliana's protector, and he was punched off his feet in a thudding series of bloody eruptions. Snake Tattoo opened fire at Arcturus, but a fleeing tourist in a floral print shirt took the volley. The unfortunate holidaymaker fell as stray slugs tore up the ground next to Arcturus, who didn't give his attacker a second chance. He sighted along the barrel of his pistol and squeezed the trigger. Snake Tattoo was spun around, his shoulder a pulped mass of shattered bone and geysering blood. He dropped his rifle and toppled backward, screaming in agony. Arcturus rose to his feet, moving sideways as the last surviving gunman swung his rifle around. Before he could fire, Arcturus put two bullets into his chest. The man toppled, dead, before he hit the ground. Arcturus let out a long, shuddering breath. Suddenly realizing how exposed he'd been. Wearing the heavy plates of combat armor granted a Marine almost complete immunity to small arms fire, but when bullets started flying, it was easy to take that immunity for granted and forget that without armor, as Arcturus certainly had been just now, even the lightest handgun was deadly. He tracked the pistol left and right, keeping on the move, though he doubted there were other shooters on the boulevard. It didn't pay to be reckless. He ghosted over to the shattered remnants of the bar, crunching on broken glass and through pulverized timber. Dozens, or maybe even scores, of bodies filled the bar, torn and mangled by the indiscriminate barrage of gunfire. Soldiers and well-heeled civilians lay together, equal in death, if not in life. Arcturus moved through the wreckage until he stood over the architect and sole survivor of this massacre. Snake Tattoo wept in pain, a gaping, raw crater where his shoulder should have been. He pawed the wound with a glistening red hand, his breath coming in sharp hikes and tortured exhalations. He looked up as Arcturus approached, his flesh waxy and streaked with sweat.
"Confed bastard,"
he wheezed between groans of pain. "What the hell was this?" demanded Arcturus. "What did you think you were going to achieve?"
"I ain't afraid to die,"
spat Snake Tattoo.
"And I ain't gonna talk. You might as well kill me now."
"Fine by me," said Arcturus, and then shot him in the face. Arcturus held Juliana close as she was racked with sobs, her shoulders heaving with the force of her distress. Her hand gripped his back, and her tears seemed never-ending. Arcturus had been through the aftermath of combat and knew how to deal with the stress and fear of close brushes with death, but this was new to Juliana, and he knew he had to let her vent her fear, anger, and grief. In the wake of the shooting, Arcturus had dropped his weapon and rushed to her side, holding her close until the Tirador armed forces arrived in screeching armored vehicles. Howling orbital flyers, brilliant white and emblazoned with winged caduces, the universal symbol of healers, landed in billowing clouds of prop wash. Green-clad paramedics spread efficiently through the crowd, treating the wounded and calming the living, as enforcement officers secured the dead attackers and gathered up fallen weaponry. Sirens and screams and shouts blended together, rising into the night sky, forever shattering the aura of invincibility the inhabitants and visitors of Tirador 9 thought they had. Until now, This had been a planet everyone believed was far from the concerns of politics and warfare. But the fallacy and naivete of that illusion had been cruelly stripped away by this atrocity. Nowhere was safe now. The long reach of violence could extend even here, the playground of the rich and powerful. Arcturus and Juliana answered a barrage of questions from a variety of officials, but after what seemed like a lifetime, they were allowed to leave the scene, though Arcturus agreed to report to the local Confederate militia station in the morning to give a fuller account of his role in the night's bloodshed. Words like hero, commendation, and medal were already being bandied around. A police flyer had taken them to Arcturus's hotel, and no sooner had they crossed the threshold of his room than Juliana broke down in tears. Arcturus guided her to the bed and sat next to her, allowing her to cry and knowing that anything he might say right now would be trite and meaningless. They sat like that for almost an hour before Juliana's sobs became less frequent, and she prized herself from his shoulder. Her eyes were puffy, and her makeup ran in black streaks down her face. Her golden hair hung limp. Her skin was ashen. She looked achingly beautiful in her vulnerability.
"I'm sorry," she said. "I look a mess. I..."
Arcturus ran a hand through her hair and kissed her forehead.
"You look far better than anyone would expect after what you've been through tonight."
"Oh, God, all those people," she said. "They killed so many people."
Arcturus nodded.
"Yes, they did. But they won't hurt anyone else. They're dead now. I killed them."
"Yes," she said. "You did. You were so brave. You saved my life."
"No," said Arcturus, trying to sound modest, but pleased at the thought of being seen as a hero.
"I just did what I had to do. Remember, I'm trained for this kind of thing. I just acted without thinking. If I'd thought about it, I'd have stayed on the ground, going up against 5 men armed with assault rifles with only a pistol. Captain Emelian will have my guts for garters when she hears that."
"She won't," said Juliana, pulling him close. "She'll think you're the bravest man she's ever met, just as I do."
Arcturus saw that Juliana had control of her emotions now, having come through the horror of the shooting with more aplomb and determination than most soldiers ever did. He saw the core of iron in her, and was reminded of the strength he saw in his mother. As her sapphire eyes met his, he saw a fierce passion there that reflected his own. The full force of what had happened tonight rushed to the fore in both of them, and reason was cast aside as they seized one another in a desperate embrace. Arcturus pressed his lips against Juliana's, and she returned his kiss with hot urgency. They tore at each other, disrobing one another with no regard for propriety. The nearness of death and the arousal of killing swept through their mingled flesh in an uncontrollable surge, and they fell together with only one thing in mind. Drowning in desire, Arcturus had wanted this since he had first laid eyes on Juliana, and he gave in to the moment without thought for the consequences. Consequences that could bind two lives together forever. Soon they would be forced apart once more, but for tonight, Arcturus and Juliana sought to purge thoughts of their own mortality by affirming their life and humanity in the most primal way possible.